Insanity. Going away on Monday. I got surgery booked on the 1st. I'm freaking out, TK. Freaking out. Too much going on. I went from like having literally nothing going on to Bazookaville. Boom. Crazyville. It's good. It's good. I got to get used to this pace again. I guess this is what it would be like doing the show alone. Generally into the most current events. So yeah. What's going on out there right now from your perspective? Because I feel like my life is making my real estate feel more busy right now.
So, I mean, when it comes to March break is always a weird time, you know? Like, we always advise people not to list during March break because people are out traveling the week before, the week after. There's always a weird sort of vibe. But then there's people who are like, hey, it's March break. And yeah.
Good time to
buy. I only have this amount of time to actually go out and look at houses and stuff like that. So it's kind of weird. Oh. It's hit and miss. I would say overall activity is always going to be a little bit down in March.
Wouldn't this be a good buying opportunity for the ones that
potentially,
are listed?
It potentially could be, exactly. So anyways, yeah. we had a good week. Things were busy, but showings were down for sure.
Showings were down,
yeah. We had a pretty booming February. And so now since March has started, which is only a couple of weeks, we're like, the showings are down. So is that March break or is that, you know, buyers are just already, the hot ones already bought? I'm not going to read too much into it. Mm-hmm. Bottom line is when people are asking me what they need to do, each person's got their own individual situation, right? So I got listings that came up during March break. I had an offer date March break. I sold it $175,000 over asking. My clients
over
got
asking.
A price that we believe is higher than what we were expecting.
Higher than what you were expecting.
Yeah. I mean, the clients wanted obviously more like anything else, but we looked at like, what's our base case? And we got more than that. Ooh-wee. Guys, thanks for watching today. If you haven't yet, drop us a like, comment, and subscribe. Hit the bell and be like Dawn, you know, get another YouTube account and double subscribe.
Double subscribe, you know, like Dawn.
You're telling everybody else to subscribe. Well, have you double subscribed?
D is for double subscribe like Dawn.
Please subscribe and...
Well, ooh-wee.
Did we get... So when was the previous sale on the street? Like, did you beat that? Was it less than that? When was that?
It's such a unique property that you can't unique. Really... Yeah, mm-hmm. Like there's semis that are like, you know, different and then there's... detached, different size detached, how close you are to Bloor will determine, you know, the value and stuff like that too. So based mm-hmm. on what we knew and what we saw, the last sale of a home like theirs that needed lots of work, we got $275,000 more. But I mean, the market was a little bit different and the condition was different too. So it's not really like, I'm not going to brag and say that that's what we did.
Can you give us the price range?
Like 1.5.
In the 1.5. Yeah. So, and we had multiple offers.
Yeah.
Multiple offers on a $1.5 million house in what area of town?
We'll call it Ossington and Newport.
Okay. So yeah. Downtown. Yeah, downtown. Outside the core, downtown. Wow. Yeah, I mean, sure.
People want to live downtown. I mean, and that's the thing is people want to live downtown. This had a laneway parking situation where there was laneway housing possibilities. A lot of guys were interested in that. Ooh. You know, there's teams out there. There's people out there right now that have amassed a squad of people looking to build multiplexes and laneway houses and garden suites. They're the small scale guys.
Yeah,
they're the small scale guys, but they're raising money.
The suckers and they're out there, get killed. Yeah.
They're out there raising money, doing well. I mean, this one that I got that I'm working on, you know, these guys have done a good job with it. And the appraisal came back in, they're making a ton of money. So like, you know, it's just maybe because they had bought it, you know, at a good price and everything else, right?
2003. So you got to buy right. Yeah.
No. They bought it like 2021. They got it for a decent price.
This is every deal. If you buy it right, you know, yeah. and you can make sense of it, especially in times where interest rates are a little higher.
Yeah. They're also very experienced with construction too.
That helps. That's
the thing is when you go in there and you do a heck of a job and you make the materials the best for rental quality, the timelines are met, all that kind of stuff is done. they've built like, you know, multiple homes that were like luxury products and stuff like that. So it was a really
so good is that thing. Who bought it? Is that who ended up buying it? Somebody that's
no, I mean, as far as I know, but people always
an end
lie.
User, right?
I think it's an investor who will eventually be an end user, but I don't know. People don't tell me the truth, you know. I hear what they say. Mm-hmm. They're buyers. Yeah, I hear what they say.
So yeah, I mean, it's an interesting kind of spot in the market. So, but I guess it's easier to pay more, like we talked about. Remember at the very beginning when the whole Laneway and Garden Suite came out, and I said, that's going to push prices up because people are going to find like a reason or an ability to pay more because of those extra suites and that income.
You might be right.
Right?
In certain situations.
Yeah. Like,
yeah. So, in certain situations, because it's a rundown house where an end user would say, oh, I got to spend all that money. But an investor goes, oh, it's a detached rundown old house,
five
with a big
units,
lot or
a
Laneway suite. And that's, yeah. Yeah, you're right.
I can pay a little bit more, especially in a bidding war situation.
But
right?
is the government focused on making prices more affordable or rents more affordable? And are those two things tied hand to hand?
Right? Are they doing either of them at all?
I'm just
are
saying, though,
serious?
But like, think about it, right? Like, are they really concerned about the, you
people?
Know, independent landlord? Are they really concerned that the person whose life savings is in their home is going to be protected? Or are they trying to put the market in a position where people who are, you know, renters are going to have more options to be able to find housing? And can those two things exist? Can we have pressure on prices continue upwards, but downward pressure on rents through the creation of more units?
Tons of more units,
right? So now each property
but
has
they can't
five
be
units.
Luxury units. They
no,
can't
I know,
be
but each unit has five.
Units.
Each property
this
has
is the
five
fuck
units,
up.
And so you know your theory. I'm just trying to, you know, just I'm asking you, is if every property now becomes more units, yes, prices go up because you can do more with them.
Land goes up first. Yeah.
Land goes up. Values go up. Everyone's like, I'm getting rich because I own real estate. Fantastic.
Fees
but
go up.
Do rents go down?
Do rents go down?
Yeah.
It depends. You cannot at the moment get enough of the right inventory on the market quick enough in order to have it make that kind of an impact.
Yeah.
Right? Is it theoretically possible? Probably not even right now, because there's not enough humans to even build it. If they said go, just go. No rules. Like, here, these are the setbacks, these are the height restrictions, go. Do your thing. Right? Here's a bunch of free money to even do it with. There's no people to actually do what's necessary to be done. And if you bring in a bunch of unskilled people to do it, I mean, imagine what the next step is going to be. Like, it's going to be people's houses falling apart or exploding because people didn't know what they were doing to build them.
Yeah.
So I guess if we get automation going at some point soon, and we can start like really pumping out a bunch of ugly, shitty little houses for people. Like,
well, okay. So first of all, Daryl, we should be going to the home show every year and doing our show from the home show.
That's
like
a
we're
good...
we're a real estate show, and we could give out t-shirts.
Yeah. And I guess we could get more subscribers. Is this where you're going right now?
No. What I'm trying
where
to say
the
is
hell are
at
you
the
going?
Home show, we would have noticed that they've got these prefab garden suites and that they've got some
innovation
in the prefab home space.
Yeah, but right? The people think it's shit. This is the problem. There's like this stigma around modular and pre-built stuff. And I think it's getting better as the necessity for it becomes greater. But up until now, there hasn't been much of a cost savings. I mean, yeah, you go to the home show now, you're going to see a garden suite.
The retail price is a huge cost savings over you know, a custom garden suite.
For sure. But I mean, has anybody lived in one of these yet? And what is that experience like? And then, like, let's talk 5 years down the road and see what that living experience is like in this thing. And maybe they're fantastic and they're amazing.
They're CSA approved, the installation,
no foundation,
and all that,
like,
and heating
it doesn't
and everything
stop
like that
there.
Is all fine.
Yeah, but there's no plumbing. You got to plumb them. You have to do all the services to the thing. It needs a foundation.
But if they're $150,000 and then you put in $50,000 in services, you got a $200,000 garden suite in your backyard.
Yeah. And then when you wake up and realize that $50,000 isn't enough for that, right? Because you need a foundation, which is going to be.
They're on slab.
slab. So then you need a new one every couple of years when the slab shifts and cracks. You got to crane it up, slab, put it back down.
Listen, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to build a shed first. All right. First, I'll build a shed and then I'll work on my garden suite.
No, but there
I've been talking about the garden suite. I just can't make sense of the numbers yet.
No, but seriously, think about it. If somebody gets a big piece of land and you really get these 3D printers going and the technology's like really there, it's just, I don't know why anybody isn't doing it, but you can have lots of cheap foundations somehow done and you can like 3D print the whole thing or have some kind of automation plus 3D printing and these things get done. But then guess what? That's all robots doing the work. And then the people don't have jobs to pay for these shitty cheap houses that we're pumping out, right?
Well, it's like people don't want to do those type of jobs. So anyways, so speaking about jobs,
and
we got
I'm excited.
Today, all right.
And
so we're going to hear
great
today.
Timing, right?
We're going to hear today from our guest. Let's bring
him on. Here right now.
Let's bring him on the show.
What great timing to talk about bankruptcies and receiverships. One of my favorite topics.
Let's see what they got going on here. I think there's some people out there right now who are struggling to pay their bills. So
did you see the carbon tax on your gas bill? Did you see your last Enbridge bill or whoever is there anybody other than Enbridge? Is there somebody other than Enbridge? I don't know if there is anybody. Maybe there is. But did you see how much they're charging on this carbon tax?
Carbon tax ain't
cheap.
It's
crazy. I got a $224 gas bill and $22 of it was for the gas. $22 for the gas. The rest was like delivery, client fee, carbon tax. HST is on top of a carbon tax. It's insanity.
Patrick,
how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
Good. So far, so good.
It's early.
Yeah, loud and clear. You can hear us okay. It's all good.
I can hear you fine.
Awesome. Perfect. Awesome.
Can you hear me?
We can hear you loud and clear. Thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
We did a little bit of a preamble here in the beginning, just sort of some banter back and forth, talking about some of the market stuff. And so we haven't really introduced you yet. Give an introduction, who you are and the company that you work for.
I'm a licensed insolvency trustee with Roosneck and Associates. I've been a trustee since 1996, and the firm has been operating since 1991. In large part, it's been a consumer practice, bankruptcies and proposals, with some corporate work throughout the years. But mostly consumer debtors, individuals who find themselves through some fault of their own, and sometimes no fault of their own, in circumstances they simply can't emerge from without the assistance of making some kind of proposal or bankruptcy. Obviously, the last resort is a bankruptcy, when there's no reasonable prospect of putting forth some kind of settlement offer. But it's not always the case. In fact, consumer proposals have been sort of leading the way for probably the last 20 years, increasing in numbers from their inception, which was 1992. So most people want to avail themselves of that option. But it's not always a viable option.
Interesting, 1992, right? So obviously there was a major, financial recession in the early 90s that we were all dealing with. Obviously, I was very young at the time, but I hear the stories and I know some of the situations. We had something similar. I mean, 2020. How was your guys' business affected?
Surprisingly, intuitively, you would have thought that insolvencies would go through the roof at the beginning of the lockdown and everything else. The opposite occurred. So insolvencies dropped dramatically during that period.
Everybody got CERB checks, right? Everybody
infusion. I was gonna say it's probably a combination of a couple of things. One was the government was pumping out gajillions of dollars
gajillions,
to people,
yeah.
and businesses, and banks and lenders were reticent to, you know, engage in the sort of normal collection activities. The optics just would have been so bad, would be my guess, that particularly for the chartered banks, who were still making profits of, you know, $3 billion every quarter or $1 billion every quarter, to be coming after people who weren't allowed to go to work. So there wasn't a lot of collection activity at the time. And of course, people were getting money.
When did you see it increase? When did you start to see it increase? I mean, was it like right when rates went up, or was it sort of more recently now after they say it's about 18 months before interest rate hikes take effect?
Whoa, hey, ow.
Ooh-wee.
Yeah, like, comment, subscribe. I'm double subscribed. Do it yourself. Didn't get to fix the show, though. Didn't get to fix the show.
Yeah, the increase has really been sort of more recent. I think banks have reengaged in fairly aggressive collection activities. The money has dried up from the government, and people are finding themselves now carrying debt loads that just aren't sustainable, either on their earnings or on their fixed incomes. Mm-hmm. There's been an increase over the last, I don't know, probably 5 to 10 years of seniors finding themselves in difficulties. And so there's sort of the baby boom generation who's hitting retirement, mm-hmm. but they're carrying debts into retirement.
And they can't, you know, hang on.
They can't, they can't pay for it, especially when they renew at a higher rate, right?
Well, certainly when it comes to, you know, if we're talking about real estate, then a lot of those baby boomers may have substantive equity in their homes, but nonetheless, the fixed incomes that they're getting aren't enough to support what mortgages they've still got left, plus increases in property taxes, utilities, and everything else, along with servicing, you know, Visa cards, lines of credits that they were carrying when they stopped working.
Why would a bank decide to do a consumer proposal with a individual who owns real estate? Let's say, you know, you've built up all this personal debt, but, you know, your house is debt free. And so then you go to the banks and say, hey, I, you know, fixed income, can't pay it anymore. Is that like the law? They have to negotiate?
No, consumer proposal? No, they don't. So when it comes to putting forth a proposal, it's very much like an election. Creditors get to vote on the approval or rejection of the proposal, just like any election. The distinction is it's not one creditor, one vote, it's $1, one vote. So, but creditors typically will make a business decision. Is acceptance of this in our best interests? Does it maximize our recovery? If it doesn't, they may very well reject it. Generally, what they're going to do is look and say, oh, here's the offer on the table. If we reject this offer, what's the alternative? Well, typically the alternative is bankruptcy. So it's very easy for them to determine, in part because I have to provide a report that lays this out, what they might anticipate in the event that a bankruptcy occurred. If the proposal provides for an amount that's similar to what a bankruptcy might, or it exceeds what a bankruptcy might, that's going to lead creditors to approve it, notwithstanding the fact that in doing so, they might be taking a haircut on what they're owed.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. If you've got somebody who owns their house outright, it is a very hard sell to convince creditors that they should take a haircut on what they're
got to put that house in somebody else's name. You know, you gotta well, change that
it
thing.
It probably
in
is already. All right? By Listen, the time they get to Patrick,
I'll go into the house. I don't know.
People must come to you with all kinds of interesting kind of setups or techniques to get
scams,
around
scams.
Scams to not pay people, or I guess funneled money towards other things instead of creditors. What are some of the most interesting kind of scenarios or webs you've seen weaved in your days?
Well, not too long ago, I dealt with an individual who's virtually everybody in the family had, over the last 8 years, filed a bankruptcy.
Like dominoes.
It's your
hot potato. Hot potato.
Just take one for the team. All right.
So, but there had been a bit of a shell game with real property, with mm-hmm. real estate, and it's my file. Was sort of the last in the line. And the individual really had never worked, quite frankly, but somehow had amassed about $180,000 in unsecured liabilities, and had engaged in a transfer of the matrimonial home, which in turn was transferred to one of the kids. And we don't always know about these things because individuals who make a bankruptcy or a proposal sign a sworn statement of their financial situation, which includes a number of questions as it relates to the disposition or transfer of real property.
Have you recently given your children a piece of real property, a gift?
Well,
in excess of 50,000.
Indeed, it's within 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
So this transfer arose. We investigated it. We pursued it. Ultimately, the government got involved as regulator of bankruptcy and insolvency matters, and they assigned the file to their special investigation unit. From that, they will determine whether somebody should have any charges placed against them. Sometimes when you've got somebody who hasn't worked or only ever worked part-time, but somehow amassed, you know, a couple hundred thousand in unsecured liabilities, it's often based on false letters of employment. Or money's being funneled into their bank accounts, but funneled out again, to look as though they're generating a level of income that they actually don't have. And unfortunately, for this particular individual, whose investigation was still ongoing with the RCMP, this individual recently passed away, sadly, but it's probably the end of the line for this investigation. But we see it fairly often. Nobody wants to lose their assets, and people have concerns about losing their assets. The classic settlement of property is transfer of the matrimonial home, and typically for natural love and affection. But it doesn't wash in the face of having debts. If somebody transfers their home and at the time of the transfer they don't have any debts, then it's fine. It can raise other issues like you incurred all of this indebtedness subsequent to the transfer, which may suggest some kind of premeditation of getting money and goods and services. with an intent of not paying. But the transfer itself is valid because the creditors ultimately aren't out anything. That's really the logic.
The name of the game, and then like my uncles taught me this, and everybody like, you know, who I know who's got experiences, you know, get the house in your wife's name, do your business, and then go and take on all the risks and all the kind of stuff that you want to. That way, you know, you always protect that matrimonial home. It's the right advice. I've seen it over and over again. I know examples. My uncle, you know, I think it was like, I don't know what it was, in the 80s or something like that, explained to me how he had a lot of bad business debts, maybe even in the 70s. And that because the house was in his wife's name, it was protected. And then once he cleared up his mess, you know, the house is protected. And then he went on to start doing more business again. Maybe he chose a little bit safer route. So that was always ingrained in me as a little kid, is that that's the goal. So now that we've got all these new changes, I mean, interest rates are coming up and people are starting to really feel the pressure. And you said that applications are starting to increase a little bit, which is, you know, to be expected. You know, what type of situations are you encountering?
Yeah, like who?
The most?
Yeah.
Is well, it they bought, is they bought a house? They refinanced? What did they, why are they in trouble?
Yeah, certainly. I've seen a couple of people. It's really just starting now with individuals starting to basically abandon homes, saying, that's it, I can't do it.
Homes that they currently live in or pre-construction homes? Oh, really?
Yeah, even homes they live in. Because bear in mind, a lot of people were dealing with their unsecured debts through second mortgages.
Right, line of credits.
Or secured lines of credit, the home equity lines. You know, and these things, home equity line can be an excellent way for individuals to sort out their unsecured liabilities.
Yeah.
If they've amassed them. The cost of servicing it is typically reasonable, and you usually only have to service the interest. Of course, you don't take anything out of the principal. But if with interest rates rising, it's put a real strain. And I think if people are anticipating that interest rates are going to drop back to, you know, a quarter point, at least at the Bank of Canada rate, that's wishful thinking. History would suggest that's not likely to occur. The era of cheap, almost free money is likely over. In anticipation of this, and I've also happened to be of an age where I have the benefit of remembering some of these things. But back in the 1970s, throughout that decade, the average Bank of Canada rate was 7%. And in the 80s, there was a spike in the early 80s where it was up to sort of 18%. But the average in the early 80s was about 6% as well. And in the 90s, 6% throughout that decade.
Yeah.
So I think if we're to look at the Bank of Canada interest rate, the 2000s, the first decade, is likely the best one to look at. And that average was about 3%.
Mm-hmm.
Which is low.
Yeah.
Which is low. I mean, 3%.
Low.
We're cheering for 3% right now.
3% would be a dream, man, right now. Right? Holy shit. But you know what? What people will argue with this, and you're 100% right. Historically, rates are still normal for sure, if not low. But the wage gap, but the gap between wages and house prices, is insane compared to those periods that you mentioned where the interest rates kind of spiked. And
oh, there's no question about that.
Right. And that's killing people all over the place.
Because it doesn't seem to matter now. We're not just talking about big centers like Toronto or Vancouver or Montreal or maybe Halifax. Any kind of search on real estate in Stratford or Brantford or Campbellford, you're still going to see prices that are unheard of. And so if, somebody has the good fortune to have a substantial down payment or when they started and all they've got is a $500,000 mortgage, which is still huge, the hit that they're going to take is going to be enormous on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
The perspective,
and it's on top of, right? It's compounding on top of the food and the gas and the kids stuff and the drugs and the cigarettes and everything is like crazy now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Here's my take on it, Patrick, is that what you just said there is very common as far as the perspective of generations who have made the right decisions as far as paying off their mortgages early. If you're under 40 years old, you look at a $500,000 mortgage as being nothing.
Nothing.
It's like, I'd love a $500,000. I took $1 million. There's people right now posting on social media their mortgage statements where it's like $1.2 million mortgage statement, $85,000 in payments, and only $1,500.
$3 in interest.
Right? And print towards the principal.
Well,
and so
this is the
shift that needs to happen is we need to get people back on track with debt is bad. That's... taking on too much mortgages is unhealthy. It's not sustainable. It will take you the entire term of your life, your working life, to pay off $1 million mortgage.
Those are people that followed the rules, though. They did put down 25-35% and they still took a $1.2 million mortgage. And then all of a sudden, their $3,800 or $4,200 payment was $8,000, right?
Yes. Absolutely.
And it's hard. Like, there's not too many people that make $4,000 more per month all of a sudden and can absorb that, or even how many people can take $1,000 extra a month and absorb it right now? Most people are like dealing with Patrick. They're in debt up to their eyeballs, or they're extended on credit cards and unsecured debts and guys named Howard on the street for 25% a month, right? Like,
I suspect that what will happen, at least in the real estate market, and you guys would know more about this than I do, but one of two things is likely to occur. People won't be able to afford servicing the property either by way of their mortgage payments or increased property taxes, utilities, and everything else.
Carbon taxes.
They'll either abandon it or they'll say, we've got to sell it. Now, that's unappetizing in an environment where rents are skyrocketing as well. But I remember reading an article probably last November or December that said there was about $250 billion in mortgages coming due this year, and about $350 billion next year in 2025. And even though interest rates may have eased somewhat by next year, it's hard to imagine that they're going back to, a five-year fixed at 1.8% or 2%. More realistically, people are going to see 5%.
This is the renewal crisis. This is the new renewal crisis. And so, it's very real. We had a few other situations where we had, something called a trigger rate crisis. And then we had a mortgage. Well, first we had the mortgage deferral cliff, and then it was the trigger rate. So now we've got this renewal crisis, but how bad is it? I mean, I only see the scenarios that I'm close to. And there's a lot of people who are struggling right now. and they can't afford that renewal price.
No, but there's eight new people that can come in and take it on.
Yeah. And so there's a lot of equity that's going to get burnt up in this market. Cause you're right. There will be people who need to sell and they will have to sell for whatever price that they can get. But what they're going to do first is, and please correct me if I'm wrong, is they're going to go to the private lenders and unsecured markets and all that type of stuff in order to borrow as much money as they can to keep their head above water, just to see if rates do come back down low enough and the market does come back high enough.
We can refinance, baby.
To be able to sustain it. Like, not too many people have the foresight. You know, you're in the business, so you're seeing things. So you might be able to say, oh, this is the situation I'm in. I'm going to make these decisions. Similar to me in real estate. With these financial decisions, people don't have the clarity. They're very foggy. They just start making one bad decision after the next until they literally can't get out of the situation anymore.
Well, but you also have the Bank of Canada that says, or the Fed go, next year there's going to be 6 rate cuts, and then it, you know, disintegrated into 3, and people are making decisions. This is what I was complaining about before, is the Bank of Canada said rates to the floor for so long, and everybody makes their decisions based on that. And then they can just say, oops, sorry. Now it's going to be this. And everybody's like, oh, okay, crap.
Well, to cut the bank some slack, I don't think the bank, either the Fed in the U.S. Or the Bank of Canada anticipated the surge in prices and inflation arising out of the pandemic. I don't think it was totally counterintuitive, the idea that the housing market went insane while people were locked down.
Right. Retrospect, though, if you think about it, when you pump trillions of dollars in the economy, lock people up and make it like you can buy a house with the press of a button. In retrospect, it seems kind of obvious that if you could get money for 0.9% and get a house and nobody was checking your income, right?
Right. Well, that may have driven it in part. But certainly, you know, my guess is that aside from those who received federal money, who ought not to have received it, they're not going to qualify. You know, somebody who got a bunch of CERB money isn't going to qualify for a mortgage. But nonetheless, property values went through the roof during a time when the world was in sort of economic, certainly uncertainty at best, and chaos at worst.
What about the SBA loans? Are there people coming to you right now because they took the $60,000 from the government and they can't pay it back to get the $20,000 relief?
Yeah, it's funny you should mention it. As I said off the top, my practice has largely been consumer for the better part of my career. over the last few months, probably about half of it, or close to half of it, has been corporate.
That's a quick shift.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, most of the corporate files are really sort of sole proprietorships in disguise.
Small businesses who are like, right? Hey.
Yeah,
I got a couple employees making over $20,000 a year.
I'm a corporation.
Sure.
No, not even that. They're just a corporation. Kind of money.
You know, it can be a truck driver who doesn't actually even own the tractor or the trailer, just provides the AZ license and drives someone else's truck, but has an incorporation to receive payment, right? Yeah. And took the $60,000. When it was available, but now is in no position to repay it. Or somebody who's got a consulting business, an IT consulting business, that kind of thing. Doesn't really have any assets, doesn't necessarily have any employees or anything
else. And the government can't go after them for anything. It's just like, hey, let's just make this go away and I'll open up a new corporation and continue to do business as usual.
Right. And yeah.
That's those are great people to give the money to. I mean, like, it just makes so sense that the government would just say, sure, no problem.
Right? Yeah, I think at the time that the you know, when all of this unfolded in early 2020, that the government was in a bit of a panic, and they're probably not the only government that was in a panic, and it was, let's get the money out, mm-hmm. and we'll clean up the mess later.
So really, all those clients, though, just from what I'm hearing, Patrick, is it's really just the government just taking a bath here. Like, it's not like it's these businesses who are employing 20 people, and then because they can't make this SBA loan repayment, they're going to be forced to close the doors and their employees all have to go. Like, most of them are just going to be like, yeah, just Patrick, fill out this paperwork for me. I got nothing. This corporation's got nothing. Make this go away. Are you a real estate agent and you're looking to make a change? Anywhere in Ontario, guess what? We're hiring. Franklin Associates, number one team in the GTA for all RE/MAX teams, number one team for all teams from all companies for number of units sold throughout Toronto. So if you're looking to make a change, best decision I ever made was to join Franklin Associates. Go to jointeamleo.com and we can set up a call.
Right. So, and if the corporations go bankrupt, that's it. The corporation ceases to function.
Yeah.
That can mean people out of work, for sure. Certainly means the government isn't collecting it. And there, of course, you know, all of the pandemic relief, and it's not just the SBA or the CERB on a personal level. You've also got the rent subsidy. You've got the wage subsidy that the government kicked out to people. Mm-hmm. And none of this holds a director's liability for the directors of companies. So
maybe should have, that would have been.
I was just going to ask that. Yeah. Immune. Right. Really?
Yeah, the only director liability is HST and source deductions.
Yeah.
So all of this pandemic relief is just sort of washed away. And the SBA was, I think, a total of $39 billion. So at 60 grand a pop, you know, it's inconceivable for the government to assign the resources to try and recover all of this.
We could have sent that money to Ukraine. Like, what the hell are they thinking?
So yeah. You're right. The government's going to be eating a lot of this, but
you know, 25%, 25% of them didn't pay it back.
The trickle down is that you and me and everyone else is going to be,
we're the one paying for it. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Somehow all of that money will ultimately have to be covered. Not necessarily through increased taxes. Hopefully not. Hopefully increased productivity and increased economic activity over time and some management.
How do you feel about their increased economic activity strategy? Like, just bring in more people and they'll work harder. You've got life experience here. Where have you seen this
got, before? That's got lots of problems as well. Some are social, some are infrastructure. Sadly, government seems to have a long history of ineffectual and poor planning. So, I need only look at Liberty Village in Toronto, with oodles of condos that went up. And not the infrastructure to service the area. So transportation is pathetic. There were no schools. They didn't plan that neighborhood properly. So you may recall, you're not old, you may recall stories of people waiting for an hour to get on a streetcar on King Street to get downtown. Some said, oh, I'll just catch the GO train to Union instead. So it requires a lot of planning to bring people in and ensure that they can function. Housing is now a crisis and a problem. I don't know what the remedy to that is. Building a whole lot of new single family dwellings north of Whitby and Pickering and Ajax and Brampton, I don't think is the answer. Certainly when you don't have the infrastructure to move people around. I've had the good fortune of having visited a fair number of European cities. They got a much deeper history, but the density is much greater in those European cities. And the transportation infrastructure is a whole lot better almost anywhere than it is in Toronto. We need more people to grow the economy, but at the same time, we got a big burden on taxpayers to put in place the housing and the infrastructure to support those people. I don't think we're there.
And we're not doing it, because when I'm driving and getting off the highway, you know, it used to just be like, you know, the, you know, sketchy Canadian guys there collecting money, you know, but now you're getting people from all different types of cultures who are new to Canada. And they're like, oh, you just stand at the highway exit and, you know, you're going to make more money there than you will at Tim Hortons, right?
By a mile.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's kind of like, obviously the government's not doing enough, but then the other side of that is the refugee support payments. I got a question for you now after this, but the refugee support payments, the more children you have, the more you get. And so a lot of these people, when they come here, it's just like, okay, let's pump out more children, because they're going to continue to support us more and more and more, which again, each situation is different, but you know, that seems like that's going to be a bill that the government's going to be paying for a long time. Are you seeing consumer proposals and bankruptcies? I mean, when someone's new to Canada and they've amassed a debt, are you seeing more of that now? People who are not?
Not necessarily. But there's no question that I think certainly people who come to Canada from developing countries where you don't have the same kind of banking infrastructure and credit infrastructure that you have here creates certain problems, not necessarily problems with individuals who take advantage of the system, because after all, it sort of takes two to tango. Banks, lenders have to lend money, and individuals have to take it. And there's no question in my mind anyway that banks and various lenders have been granting money to individuals who they ought not to have.
Oh, for sure. That's happening a ton, TK. There's a lot of people coming in here abusing those systems. They're not going to a guy named Patrick Bloomfield, okay? Right. They're going to a guy with a very different name than him to help them out if they're going anywhere at all. But you go to a sporting event, you can leave that place with a new credit card with a $1,000 limit or a $500 limit. And if you, like, your dog can get a credit card these days. Yeah. It's not hard to get a credit card. So if you just go around and get a few credit cards and abuse those a little bit, like, it's not hard to do these days. And I mean, some places are just giving out unsecured line of credits to people that are coming in with fake paperwork saying, you know, that it's got to be a real clusterfuck, because people don't have normal ways to make money here. There's not enough jobs for people to make the kind of money they want or need to make quickly. So they're coming up with other things, like stealing cars and all these scams in the banks and like insider. I have a partner who, like, there definitely some guy inside the bank helped some guy outside the bank embezzle a bunch of money. Okay. And they weren't like local Toronto guys. And I have nothing against immigration and immigrants, but like the screening process is abysmal. We're bringing in anybody and everybody, and we're not, like you're saying, there's no infrastructure, there's no services, there's no support for them other than to put them in a shitty motel or some hotel and continuously give them money. And who wouldn't abuse this system? Honestly, like if you can live in a hotel for free and get food and get checks, like this sounds pretty good.
Having babies.
To me. I'm going if I have a chance.
There's no question that what you say is true about getting credit cards. You know, there are some credit card companies where seemingly all you need is a pulse, and you get one. Regardless of your circumstance. Now, all of this, long before you gentlemen entered your professional lives, a lot of this all started with deregulation back in the 1980s during the Reagan, Thatcher, Mulroney years. And that's when the proliferation of and the notion of unsecured lines of credit and all this linking of credit cards, you know, with a MasterCard that also is your gas card and Canadian Tire card and all of those kinds of things. I mean, the first one I remember was the GM TD Visa, okay? And I remember dealing with a young woman back in the early 90s, maybe the mid 90s, who was a cashier at a Green Pea parking lot. And she had an unsecured line of credit from Canada Trust, as it was then.
Canada Trust.
Of $10,000.
Wow.
And
that's a lot of money back then.
Well, and we're talking, you know, 93, 94, something like that. But her job, she was a cashier at a Green Pea parking lot.
Yeah.
Right. So she took people's money and gave them a ticket to put in their dashboard. She couldn't have been making more than $8 an hour at the time. And there, Canada Trust gave her a $10,000 line of credit. And from my perspective, it was utter madness.
One of those Canadian Tire cards that you're talking about. And I'll tell you, back when I was in high school, I started my first business with cash advances from that credit card.
Sure.
I had a $350 limit on this card. And I went there and I took $350 cash out. I was like, oh, that's kind of cool. Went back the next day. Asked for some more money. They gave me another $350. Because back then it was like, you know, you signed for something. There's no computer system. It was like 3 days in a row they gave me $350 cash. They didn't even know that they gave it to me the day before and the day before, right? So all of a sudden I got $750 cash and I'm 16. So that was my seed money for my first business. It's crazy that they gave me even a credit card at all. Okay. I didn't have a job. I was 16. Like, but this is what happened. This is back then. It's so much looser now. Now you go to the hockey game, you leave with a t-shirt and an MBNA card.
Yeah. So, credit is ubiquitous. It's everywhere. And as I say, it doesn't take a lot, in order to get whatever credit you want. Which is, you know, the Bank of Canada has also been warning about the level of consumer debt in Canada, not just recently, but for years now. And everybody's sort of over-leveraged. And at some point in time, there's going to be a hit. But banks have given it out because they've been making money hand over fist, and they're making it at both ends. You know, whenever you use that card, they're getting 1.5-2% of whatever that purchase is, and they're getting it at the back end when you don't pay the balance in full. And if they were losing money hand over fist, they would be tightening their credit requirements, but they're not.
One question I have, just lots of money. Just to go back on something that you had mentioned. You said before, during the 2020 years, the banks weren't really acting on some of the people's bad debts. So what are the things now that you've seen where the banks are, you know, more, you know, strictly enforcing collecting these debts? What are they doing now?
Well, there's been increased aggressive activity on the collection agency front. So these are third-party companies who have accounts assigned to them, or in some cases, these companies buy the debt at a discounted rate from the bank or from the lender, and then chase after the full amount owing. There are also more statements of claim, more court actions taking place than there were. In part, you know, that may also be a function of the courts pivoting to online. Very much a learning curve for, I think, everybody. The courts, lawyers, trustees, all of my court stuff is now on Zoom. When it used to, you know, the last time I was in court was 2019 now, physically in court.
Yeah, I feel like bankruptcy court is definitely one of those courts that they can do online.
Yeah, by and large, if there are matters that are going to be what they call long matters, maybe an hour or more, they'll typically do it in person.
But they're not interrogating any witnesses. It's just submitting information.
And so in large part, that's the case. Yeah. And debtors and individuals can be sworn in online, just the same way that can be sworn in a physical court. But I think, you know, the optics would have been very bad to see, you know, Royal Bank, TD, BMO, CIBC.
Start
come after people
those statements
blasting.
Yeah.
While people were locked down,
and while they're making record profits,
and they were making the same amount of money, right?
So, what about going to jail? What's the sort of financial level, like the severity of, you know, people's scams or debts that could, you know, end up winding them in jail,
charged criminally? I've never seen anybody wind up in jail.
That's good to know.
In
well, kind of doesn't large, really deter anybody from trying to scam.
It's sort of,
right, that's why so many people are stealing cars, because nobody gives a shit.
No one goes to jail anymore.
It kind of makes sense. You know, 150 years ago, there was debtor's prison. And you would go to jail and you wouldn't get out until your debt was paid. Well, how are you going to pay it if you're behind bars?
Yeah.
And so that didn't benefit anybody. The government still had to keep the person in prison or in jail.
Cost them money.
And so you had the emergence of insolvency law in the UK and in Canada. So even when there is convictions for fraud, it usually amounts to restitution orders. So
go back to work. You're ordered to repay
however much, right? $100,000, $60,000, whatever it is. And in the context of bankruptcy, when these investigations take place, charges are laid and convictions are entered, it's what's called a freestanding restitution order in favor of the trustee, and the person has to pay this. They don't go to prison. They don't go to jail. They've got a conviction, and it's under a federal statute, typically, the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act. But they have to pay their debt, and the bankruptcy doesn't release them from it.
Just the last question here, Patrick. What's the biggest amount of unsecured debt you've ever seen somebody file bankruptcy for and so that they didn't have to pay it?
Probably about $5 million.
Oh, what's that guy doing now? Yeah.
Now, in part, that wasn't just like credit cards and lines of credit. That also happened to be business an individual. Part it was business.
I borrowed $500,000 off Daryl and promised I'd pay it back.
That's right. This guy had he had invested.
He bought a Lambo.
Just a plethora of real estate. So he had about, he had bought and sold and oodles of properties. And when he finally got stuck, so he started in the late 80s. And there was that speculative bubble in the late 80s. And it all started to crash and burn in 1990-91. And he got saddled with being on the hook for a boatload of mortgages on properties that had dropped in value and had been taken over by mortgagees. And so he wound up with about $5 million in unsecured liabilities as a result. So it wasn't just like, you know, Visas and MasterCards, although that was part of it. It was just a lot of debt. And back in the early 90s, property values were precipitously dropping, like every month. And the trough was really about 1996, when properties dropped to their bottom and then started to go up again. And this is a problem. This was a problem back then, and I suspect it's going to be a problem again for some people. A lot of people were investing their RSPs, TFSAs, this kind of thing, in second mortgages, figuring it's dead safe, it's secure, and I'm getting a return of 10% or 12%.
Go wrong. The guy's done it 3 times already, and he's paid back all his investors. He's a pro. He knows what he's doing. Timmins, Ontario is the new place that everyone's moving to.
It's new Bradford.
New Brunswick is just
so hold on. So
boiling out of control.
This is a perfect segue to my last question. Are you good, TK? Did you get out? Yeah. So I think there's a perfect segue to, and it's always interesting to hear what people say, especially if they're not inside the real estate space. Based on everything going on right now and what you know and your perspective, what would you guess is going to be the next move with interest rates?
I suspect interest rates may drop, but there are a whole lot of external factors that, you know, there's really nothing Canada can do about it. What's going to happen with the war in Ukraine? What's going to happen in the Middle East? What's going to happen in Taiwan? Nobody really knows. There's a lot of uncertainty, and the world's a bit of a shit show at the moment. And society is fractured. So I suspect that interest rates will decrease a bit, but not much, you know. And bear in mind that people often get fixated on the overnight lending rate by the Bank of Canada. Well, that's not what you pay, obviously, right? That's what the bank pays. You pay the bank a whole lot more than that.
Yeah.
So I don't know what variable rates are right now, probably 6.5 to 7, somewhere in that range. You gentlemen know more than I do. And fixed rates are probably in the high 5s, or, you know, 5.5 anyway. Yeah. Six.
Low 6.
Okay. So even if the Bank of Canada rate drops back down to 4% or even 3%, the rates that the banks are going to be offering, that, you know, individuals are going to be paying for their mortgages, is still going to be at least two, maybe still three times higher than what they might have been paying in 2019 or 2020.
Yeah. Those right? guys that everybody was so jealous of that had that 1% friggin' loan, those guys are going to be in a lot of trouble in a year.
Yeah,
or two.
Sure. Sure.
Right? I bought a $3 million house. I'm paying almost nothing every month for this thing. And then, bam, this is going to be nuts.
Yeah. And I don't know what's going to happen with housing, whether people get dinged to the extent that they can no longer service the mortgage. It doesn't have to be the mortgage. They might be able to make the mortgage, but not pay the property taxes.
Sure.
Or sustain the utilities. So, you know, if there winds up being powers of sale, or people say, I've got to get out of this house and hopefully get out and get some of my equity now. And there winds up being a flood of properties on the market. Well, values are going to take a hit, right?
Everybody's and sometimes this is like that a flood. Continue.
That's a good soundbite.
Everybody's
right
waiting for that flood, though, and the flood yeah, just doesn't it can be seem like
a crisis.
It's a contagion, yeah. And people follow. Say, oh, I got to get out of my house now. They're starting to drop in value. And that's not, you know, these things do take time. As you were talking about interest rates, a year and a half to work their way into the economy. With the $350 billion that I saw coming due in 2025, as I say, even if those mortgages or, you know, the Bank of Canada rate is dropped down to 2 to 3%, and I don't really think it's likely to go back to 0.25%, but even if it goes back to 2 to 3%, those people are still going to be looking at payments that are going to be double,
yeah,
possibly triple what they're paying now.
That's so crazy, hey? They thought they were so smart. That's just going to be nuts. Hopefully, but again, the real problem is that people are there to buy those houses. It's not that like people are waiting on the sidelines. Like people need to buy these houses. And TK's talking about $1.5 million houses right now getting bidding wars. Like this is crazy that there's that many people that with today's numbers can make that work. And there's a lineup of them on multiple properties. TK?
I think
it's time.
Patrick, we're at the end of the show. Yeah. But we appreciate it. Where can people find you? So there's a lot of people struggling out there. How do people contact you?
Okay. So they can look us up online at debt-experts.ca.
Genius name, yeah.
And the firm's name is Rusinek and Associates. And we've got a number of offices across the GTA, Brampton, Mississauga, Toronto West, Toronto East. So just look us up online. You'll get all the contact information and they'll see my smiling face there too. I'm happy to speak with people. It's not always the case that that an insolvency trustee is the right person to help them out. Sometimes there are other alternatives that
real estate agent
sense. We discuss all those options with individuals. If our service is right for them, we explain how those options operate, what responsibilities and obligations are. And then individuals make a decision what's in their best interests. There will always be the limitation of income and expenses. So that's always got to be factored in. At the moment, people are still managing in many respects, but it becomes a juggle, you know? borrow from Peter to pay Paul.
Yeah.
So these things are, you know, and eventually you hit a wall where there's just no more money to juggle.
Well, if someone's in that situation, Patrick, we definitely think that you're somebody that they should reach out to just to see if you can help them in any way. And a real estate agent is also another good option too. Yeah. So
individuals should always reach out to a licensed insolvency trustee.
Yeah.
There are lots of sort of non-regulated businesses out there that hang a sign out their door saying, we arrange proposals or we're going to restructure your debt, but they have no regulator.
Be careful.
Be careful who you approach. Always talk with a licensed insolvency trustee, regulated and licensed by the federal government.
Perfect. Patrick, we appreciate your time today. And it was very nice chatting with you.
It was an absolute pleasure.
I appreciate it very much.
Thank you for the invitation. I really enjoyed it.
Okay. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.
Okay. I'm going to do my best. You as well, gentlemen.
Okay. Thanks, Patrick.
Care. Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much.
Please subscribe and...